So in our final lecture together, we're going to discuss asymptotics. And so why are we discussing this topic? So first of all, we often want to understand the behavior of functions or solutions to differential equations when a parameter is large and small. Taking limits is to simplify things is something we do all the time in physics. Secondly, when we do perturbation theory in quantum field theory, a essential step in deriving perturbative results is swapping a sum in an integral. And this is dangerous if you want to have a convergent series at the end. And let me explain a bit why by looking at a toy model, is basically a zero-dimensional path integral. So we can define a function z of lambda to be the integral of e to the minus, from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus x squared minus lambda x to the fourth over x. So this is the limit, if we take the number of dimensions to zero, of a scalar field theory with a self-interaction term that's a phi to the fourth term. And so if we wanted to evaluate this integral in using perturbation theory in lambda, what we'd have to do is write this as a series. But in yesterday's tutorial, first I promised to derive the simplest result, the basic Gaussian integral. So the reason we would want to evaluate this function using a perturbation theory is we know how to evaluate integrals of x to the n versus e to the minus x squared. So you saw that in the last problem in yesterday's tutorial. And I'd assumed that you knew how to evaluate the basic Gaussian integral, which I'm sure most of you have seen, but I just want to remind you how that works. So if we take z of 0 squared, that's just the integral of e to the minus x squared minus y squared dx dy. And if we switch to polar coordinates, this becomes integral from 0 to 2 pi, integral from 0 to r, 0 to infinity, e to the minus r squared r dr d theta. And there's a 2 here from the change of variables. No, there's not. That's right. And this integral can be evaluated very easily. We make the change of variables u equals r squared. So if we do that, first of all, we can do the theta integral, get 2 pi. We get then the integral from 0 to infinity of, there's a half from the change of variables from u equals to r dr, e to the minus u du. And so this integral just evaluates to a half, so we're left with pi. And z of 0 is root pi. That's the basic trick for evaluating Gaussian integrals. And in tutorial yesterday, you saw how to evaluate x to the n against e to the minus x squared. So we can evaluate z of lambda by writing e to the minus lambda x to the fourth as a series. And if we do that, what we get is e to the minus x squared times a sum from n is 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n lambda to the n x to the 4 n over n factorial dx. And so if we can swap the sum and the integral, we know how to evaluate each of the terms in the sum. So let's just assume we can do that and see what happens. So this may or may not be valid. And we have factors out here, minus 1 to the n over n factorial and lambda to the n. OK. So we know how to evaluate these integrals. You saw one way to do that in the last problem in the tutorial yesterday. We can also do this using a change of variables. So if we let u equal x squared, then this becomes sum n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n lambda to the n over n factorial. And the integral is an integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus u to the 2n minus a half, which we can recognize from Wednesday as a gamma function. So this is just the sum of minus 1 to the n, lambda to the n over n factorial, times gamma of 2n plus a half. OK. So this is the basic technique behind perturbation. Perturbative calculations in QFT. So we do this all the time. Now let's think about what a result means. So if n is large, then gamma of 2n plus a half is approximately 2n factorial, which is certainly greater than n factorial squared. So we've got something that's bigger than n factorial squared, only one n factorial in the denominator. So the terms don't converge. The coefficients of each term diverge, and the series does not converge. So this overwhelms the n factorial in the denominator. And what we found is not a convergent series. This does not converge to this. It does, however, contain some information about this function z of lambda that we were originally interested in. And the right-hand side is what's known as an asymptotic expansion. So it does contain information about z of lambda, but it's not equal to z of lambda. So let me explain what we mean by an asymptotic expansion so we can see what we've learned. Any questions on that? Yes.
So
if we're summing a series, an infinite series that converges, some series converge absolutely and it doesn't matter the order. Other series, it does matter the order, and we can change the results based on the order we add up the terms. And it's the same kind of thing here. Okay. So what do I mean by an asymptotic expansion? So let's have a few definitions. So first of all, we'll say that f of x is much, much less than g of x as x goes to x naught if the limit as x goes to x naught of f over g is zero. Okay. Secondly, we'll say that f is asymptotic to g as x goes to x naught if f minus g is much less than g, or assuming everything is non-zero, the limit x goes to x naught f of x over g of x is 1. Okay, so this is what we mean by asymptotic. It means that as we get closer to the point, the two functions approach each other. But notice that it doesn't say anything about how the functions behave if we're a finite distance away. And finally, we can define an asymptotic series. Okay, so we say that y is asymptotic, has an asymptotic series given by an infinite sum of an x minus x naught to the n as x goes to x naught if y minus the finite sum from n to 0 to big N of an x minus x naught to the n is much less than x minus x naught to the n as x goes to x naught for all big N. Okay. So what this is saying is that an asymptotic series becomes a better approximation as we get closer and closer to x naught, which we should contrast to a convergent series, which gets better becomes a better approximation as we take more and more terms. So let me sketch what we mean. So suppose we're approximating some function f. This is f. This is x. This is x naught. So we have a convergent series. We might have that one term looks like this, and the next term looks like this. draw this again. We might suppose approximate the first term, say with a line, then a parabola, and a higher order polynomial. And if we're interested in the value of f at x, as we take more and more terms, the approximation will approach f of x if we take enough terms. That's different from a convergent series. So that is a convergent series. It's different from an asymptotic series. So convergent series becomes a better approximation. More terms. For fixed x. An asymptotic series, on the other hand, has to be a good approximation to f near x naught, but if we look at it far away, it could do something different. So we could have the first approximation perhaps do something like this. This would be the first one. The second one maybe is a better approximation at x. But the third one could do something different. It approaches f of x naught more quickly near x naught, but it might out here be a worse approximation. So this could be a worse approximation far away. Okay, so what I said from the diagram, it's a little bit crowded now, but is that if we're interested in the value of f at x, and we have a convergent series that converges to f in some region around x naught, if we take more and more terms in our series, we'll get a better approximation to f at x. That's not true if we have an asymptotic series. If we take more and more terms, we could get a worse approximation. All that we know is that it goes to f of x naught more quickly as we take x towards x naught. Yes, convergent series are a special case, yeah. But asymptotic series are not. Assuming that they converge in the range that you're interested in. So, asymptotic series become better approximations as x goes to x naught for a fixed number of terms. So a few comments about this. So let's suppose we have the asymptotic series for some function f of lambda. As lambda goes to 0. Then the asymptotic series for f of lambda plus some constant times e to another constant over lambda is going to be the same. As lambda goes to 0. And that's because e to the minus c over lambda is much less than than x to the n for every n. So the asymptotic series does not contain all of the information about the function f. And this kind of term that's missed by an asymptotic series is what's known as a non-perturbative term. And so in our first few QFT courses, we'll learn how to do perturbation theory. But you should always keep in mind that we're missing, potentially missing some information. And these types of terms can be important in certain circumstances. They mediate things like vacuum decay and tunneling. So in the review and exploration courses, we'll discuss where these kind of terms come from. Most of the time, they tend to be important if a process is forbidden perturbatively. One other comment. So we have that f of z is asymptotic to g of z as z goes to 0 for complex z. This is generally only valid in a finite wedge in the complex plane. And this is what's known as Stokes' phenomenon. So the most useful method for obtaining asymptotic series requires an integral. So that's one of the main reasons why we're discussing this, is we're going to be computing asymptotic expansions for integrals that are infinite dimensional versions of the one I wrote on the first board. So let's look at an example and see how the method works. So Stirling's approximation is an approximation to the factorial or the gamma function for large values of the argument. And so if we look at our definition of the gamma function, we notice that the integrand, if x is very large, goes to 0 very rapidly as t goes to 0. It also goes to 0 as t goes to infinity, fairly rapidly. So the integrand, we expect, is only large in some small region. And so that's the going to be the basic idea behind our whole approximation, is we're going to assume that this integrand only has support in some small region. And if we can massage this to make it look like a Gaussian integral, then we can evaluate it. So that's going to be the basic idea behind all of our approximations today. We know how to do Gaussian integrals, so let's exploit that. To make this look like a Gaussian integral in a small region, we can make change of variables t equals wx. And what we get is x to the x plus 1 integral e to the minus x w minus log w dw, which I'm going to denote as e to the minus x f of w dw. Okay. So now, so x here is some large parameter. If we can replace f by a Taylor series, then we can make this thing look like a Gaussian integral, or if we go to higher order, like an integral that has perhaps higher order terms too. But we expect that the dominant contribution to this integral comes from the region where f is a minimum. And as f increases away from that minimum value, the integrand goes to zero very rapidly. So f has a minimum when, so f prime is 1 minus 1 over w. So this is 0 when w equals 1. So the maximum value of the integrand is at w equals 1. And if we Taylor expand around that region, so trivially we can compute the second derivative and just get 1 over w squared. So f of w is approximately 1 plus 1 half w minus 1 squared, plus higher order terms, near w equals 1, which is where the dominant contributions to the integral come from. So if we plug this into our result for gamma, we get x plus 1, e to the minus x, integral 0 to infinity, e to the minus x over 2, w minus 1. And we neglect the dot 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 terms, we know how to evaluate this integral. Except there's one problem. Our limits are wrong. But that shouldn't make a big difference. Squared, thank you. That shouldn't make a big difference. The integrand is large only near w equals 1. So if we just change the limits of integration from 0 to infinity to minus infinity to infinity, we're adding something to the integral, but not a lot, because the integrand should be tiny in that region. So let's go ahead and do that. Assuming x is large enough, we're not changing the value of the integral when we do that. So this is approximately x plus 1, e to the minus x, integral from minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus x over 2, w minus 1 squared. And you all know how to evaluate this integral, just a Gaussian integral. It's shifted, but we can just make a change of variables. W goes to w minus 1. And we get x, the x plus 1, e to the minus x, root 2 pi over x. And so that is Stirling's approximation. If we kept more terms, I'm not going to go through the derivation, but if we kept more terms, what we would have to do, so I neglected this dot, 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 is we don't know how to evaluate integrals of e to the minus x squared plus higher order terms. We can do the same thing we did before with that toy model and expand these terms. Expand e to the dot, 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 and write this as e to the minus x squared over 2 w minus 1 squared times some expansion of this. Where these coefficients would depend on precisely what the dot, dot, dot was. So if we did that, we would get an asymptotic series, not for gamma of x plus 1, but for gamma of x plus 1 divided by these factors. So we'd get an asymptotic expansion that looked like this. And the next term is 1 over 12x. And so this is valid as x goes to infinity. So this is general. So if we try to compute an asymptotic series from a integral using a method like this, we won't necessarily get an asymptotic expansion for the function we're interested in, but it'll be a ratio of the function to some other functions. That's good enough for most purposes. I know.
So here x naught is like infinity, right?
That's right.
What does the statement become for how well it's converging for large n?
So the way to do that would be to do a change of variables x goes to 1 over x, and then you could use this definition. So,
as x gets large, the error is like 1 over x to the n or something.
That's right, yeah.
Can you do something similar to toy examples to make up?
Can you repeat?
Can you do something similar to the toy model to make it work?
Make it work. So this is a valid asymptotic expansion.
Oh, okay.
It is. So if we wanted to correct this, all we would have to do is replace the equal sign with an asymptotic 2 sign. Okay.
So then if we change the integration of the summation.
Yes, so this it's equal is not correct. Asymptotic 2 is correct.
Where is it asymptotic to that? For what x 0?
So this is as lambda goes to 0. So that's a small but important change, because asymptotic series, we can miss these non-perturbative terms. So it's not equal. Okay. So that was a particular example. Let's try to generalize the method. And see how it works. If we have, instead of a real integral, a contour integral. Are there any questions on this method before I move on? This? So I made it. This comes from the fact that we Taylor expanded this f of x, and I kept only up to the second order terms. This dot, dot, dot represents the cubic and higher order terms. And what we did going from here to here is we just Taylor expanded this function.
Then, we came to the next
line. So I showed this. If you kept this term, you would get a 1 over 12. You would have to actually compute it, but I didn't do that. Okay, so I'm about to describe to you is called the saddle point method. And the basic idea is the same as before. We're going to start with some integral and massage it until we get it into something that looks like a Gaussian that we know how to deal with and evaluate. So let's suppose we start with an integral. It's a function of some parameter z. It's given by a contour integral over some contour c of g of w e to the z f of w dw. And let's suppose we want an asymptotic expansion for f for large real z. Not necessarily. Okay. So again, like in Stirling's approximation, we might expect the dominant contributions come from. First, let me rewrite this as e to the z times, I'll write this as u of w plus v of w, where u of w is the real part of f of w, and v of w is the imaginary part of f of w. Okay. So as before, we might expect a dominant contribution to this integral comes from the region where the integrand is largest. So that would mean if z is large, the integrand being largest is when u has a local maximum. But because this is a complex exponential, we also need to demand that v is approximately a constant in the region where u has a local maximum. Otherwise, the contributions with different phases would just cancel out. So let's suppose that our contour looks something like this. So this is our contour C. Here, this is x and this is y, where w equals x plus iy. And let's suppose that the point at which these conditions are satisfied is w naught. So this is where the dominant contribution comes from. We can denote the tangent vector to the curve at this point by t hat. Okay. So let's put these conditions into equations. So we have the first condition that u is a local max says that gradient of u dot t equals 0. This is the condition that u is a local max. Okay. The second condition, the gradient of v dot t is 0 if v is approximately constant. So this is the stationary phase condition. Now, we also have a third condition that comes from the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And that's that grad u dot grad v is 0. And what do you notice about these equations? So these equations say that u is orthogonal to t. That's right. So we have three orthogonal vectors, but our space is only two-dimensional. So two of them, well, at least one of them has to be 0. All right. So we have, this has three orthogonal vectors. They're mutually orthogonal vectors. So at least one has to be 0.
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm.
Okay.
If there is no response, the conference will end.
So let's suppose that grad u is 0 at W naught. And the Cauchy-Riemann equations tell us that partial u partial x, which is 0, has to be equal to partial v partial y. And similarly, partial u partial y, which is also 0, has to be equal to minus partial v partial x. So that means that grad v is 0, too. So putting these two, and if we assumed grad v was 0, we'd also get that grad u is 0. So putting these conditions together, this tells us that f prime of w naught is 0. And W naught is a critical point or inflection point or saddle point So this is, we demand that these three conditions must hold at W naught. We also want the phase to be stationary near, in a small region of the path near W naught. So we also have 2 and 3. Along the path near W naught. Okay. So if grad V is, so we have, if we have this condition, 2 along the path, grad V is perpendicular to the tangent vector. That means that grad U, which is always perpendicular to grad V, has to be parallel to T. So this says that grad U is parallel to T. And grad U tells us about the change in the real part. So we have to go along the steepest descent. But
I'm sorry, I did not get how you grad U is parallel.
So we're imposing 2 and 3 along the path. So 2 says that V is perpendicular to T. U says that, 3 says that grad U is perpendicular to grad V. And the only way that's possible in a two-dimensional space is if grad U is parallel to T hat.
But then the first condition is not going to hold.
The first condition holds at that point because these two vectors become zero. But in a small region away from that, we still need to impose 2. We can't impose 1.
I assume if we set grad V equals 0, then we get the function 0 everywhere or something like that.
That's right, yeah. Or at least in the region around that. OK. So and we also know that U has no max. Because partial squared U, partial x squared equals minus partial squared U partial y squared. So that's why it's called the saddle point approximation. Because if it was a local max, we'd have both of these derivatives being simultaneously negative. It's only one can be negative at a time, so it's a saddle point. Okay, so we're trying to massage our integral I into a Gaussian integral that we can approximate. So what we need to do is expand f of w in a neighborhood of w naught. And we just shown that its first derivative at W naught is 0. So the expansion takes the form f of W naught plus 1 half W minus W naught squared F W double prime of W naught plus higher order terms. And it's going to be useful to pull out the phase of the second order term. Because if we want to approximate this as a Gaussian integral, we know how to do Gaussian integrals where the parameter we're integrating against is real. And we also want the coefficient to be negative. In the exponent. So, okay. Okay, so let's take our contour. And linearize the path near W naught. So the path near W naught is W equals W naught plus e to the I phi t, where t is real. And this angle here is phi.
When you say linearize, you mean to form the curve phi.
That's right. So we're performing some deformation of our contour in a small region. So we deform our contour like that. If the region is small enough, then that's not going to change the value of the integral. So what we want is we want f of w to be f of w naught minus 1 half t squared times some positive real number. If we plug this in, this gives us the Gaussian integral. So let's compare what we have and what we want. So what we have is W minus W naught squared e to the I delta naught. And this, using the fact that we've linearized our path, can be written as e to the 2 I phi e to the I delta naught t squared. And what we want is this to be equal to minus t squared. So we have e to the 2 I phi e to the I delta naught is equal to e to the plus or minus I pi. And so this determines the angle. So this gives us the angle. And we have that, yeah, so phi equals plus or minus I pi over 2 minus delta naught over 2. No, we don't have to choose it to be tangent. We can make a deformation where we change the angle we go through that point a little bit.
It's like fitting it with a line.
That's right. So I've drawn it here tangent. We have to choose phi to be this value if we're going to be able to do a Gaussian integral. So,
we can fit it with a real line, but we're putting
We can fit it with any line, but we might, there's a particular line that we have to choose.
Yeah, so we have a constraint that we have to go as near to W not as possible.
It intersects W not. We also have the condition that like it has to approach W not on either sides along this line.
We have the condition that if we want to make the approximation that the dominant contribution comes from this point, we have to approach this point along a particular line where this angle is given by this formula. And the plus or minus will be determined by global considerations. So we may be able to deform a contour to approach W naught along this direction without changing the contour drastically, but perhaps not in the other direction. Yes.
Settle in three dimensions, which is kind of bad because we've got a function that's from 2D to 2D, so it's like a four-dimensional kind of thing. But I mean, if we take this, consider this as the real part of our function, and then we're doing this linear, like this line, what kind of, like, where on the saddle are we kind of going? Are we going over, like, the one of the parabolas, or are we trying to cut through the, like, the side?
So we're going along the steepest descent direction. Yes. That's, that comes from basically this condition. Okay, so what does this tell us? Let's plug our results back into our formula. Okay, so, and the comment here, the plus and minus is determined by global conditions. Okay, so what we have is I of z is approximately e to the z f of w naught integral from minus t1 to t1 g of w naught plus e to the I phi t e to the minus z over 2 t squared f double prime of w naught dw dt valued at t0 dt. So what have I done here? So first of all, I've plugged in our approximation for f. Secondly, I have done a change of variables from w to t. That's where this factor comes from. And third, I've said that our linear approximation to the contour integral is good in some small region between minus t1 and T1. Okay. So that's our integral. And it's almost in an approximation. Almost in a form where we can perform the integration by Gaussian integration. The only thing left we need to do is Taylor expand G, because we know how to evaluate t to the n against the Gaussian, and expand our limits of integration. Just like so, those two steps are the same as we saw in Stirling's approximation. So what we get is I of z is approximately e to the z f of w naught g of w naught plus g double prime w naught over 2 factorial e to the 2i phi t squared e to the minus z over 2 t squared f double prime w naught e to the I phi dt. All right, almost there. We've tortured this integral till it looked like a Gaussian, and now it is a Gaussian, and we can do the integration. So I've left off a term, the first order term in the expansion of G. Can anyone tell me why? So it's a critical point of F. We haven't assumed anything here about G. But I claim that I haven't made any approximations really. In, well, it's an odd term, that's right. So even if I kept this term, it wouldn't change our result. So only the even terms contribute. Okay. So from here, it's a simple exercise to do the Gaussian integrals. You all know how to do. And the result shows some nice implications. So in particular, when I write down the result, you'll see that the angle actually drops out. So we've come up with an asymptotic expansion for I of z, because in order to perform the Gaussian integration, we need to swap the sum and the integral again. And what we get is this. Formula. There's no absolute value signs here. Okay. So absolute value signs drop out because F, the absolute value of F double prime of W naught is equal to e to the minus 2i phi F double prime of W naught. And you'll notice in the formula up there, every place where we would have a absolute value of F double prime of W naught, we also have a factor of e to the I phi. So we can just recombine everything into F double prime of W naught. And phi drops out. Second thing to notice about this formula is that the dot, dot, dot can break down at some point. So the reason for that is that we neglected the higher order terms in F. So at some point, those become more important than the higher order terms in G. But typically, we're only interested in the first one or two or three terms. And for most practical applications, the higher order terms in F don't matter. But you can't use this formula to get arbitrarily high orders in G. Yes?
On the bottom, is that 12 or 1 factorial 2?
It's a 1 factorial 2. So the next term would have a 2 factorial and a 2f. squared, I believe.
Okay.
This is F double prime, yes.
And my second question is, when you're, if you're going to do something like this, you have to pick your contour carefully to make sure it passes through the saddle point, right? Because otherwise you won't get any points to satisfy our two conditions of being like locally, like B being locally constant and U being...
Correct. In tutorial this afternoon, you'll look at some examples.
Right.
Of doing that.
That's right.
Any questions on this? I'll move on to an example of how we can use this. So this all assumes that we have an integral representation for the quantity we're interested in. So there are a variety of ways to construct these integral representations for functions we're interested in. Dennis will tell you about one way using Green's functions the week after next. You'll see another way in tutorial. It's far from an exclusive list of constructing integral representations of quantities that you can't compute explicitly. There's a wide variety of methods, which I don't have time to discuss all of, but I can point you to references that explain some other ones if you're interested. So for now, I'm just going to assume we have an integral representation, and let's look at an example of how this works. So it's supposed to be a course on special functions. So let's look at the Hankel function, which has an integral representation that's given by the following formula. Integral over this contour, which I'll draw in a minute, iz cosine w e to the I nu w dw. And this is the contour C1. It asymptotes to minus pi and pi and passes through the origin. Something like that, yeah. Okay. So if we want to use the saddle point approximation, we've already done the vast majority of the work. So we can just basically need to identify our functions g and w. So g is here just e to the I nu w. Oh, and we want to approximate this as for large real z. So g is just the term that doesn't depend on z. F is just the term that does depend on z, so I cosine w. And we can find the critical points just by taking derivatives, just minus I sine w. And we see that the critical points are when w is equal to n pi, for n an integer. And we also need the second derivative of w. And very easy, just minus I cosine w. And so there's infinitely many critical points here, something we should notice. But only one is relevant for our particular contour. So the other critical points here and here, for instance, we'd have to change the value of our integral in order to deform our contour to pass through those points. So only W equals zero contributes. Okay. And as we saw, the angle drops out, but we can calculate it because we know we can compute the argument of f prime at zero using this formula. And what we get is the angle here has to be minus pi over 4. So our two solutions would be minus pi over 4 or 3 pi over 4. And this contour is in this direction. Yes?
Given the singularity of the origin of the function, is that I think we have a singularity. We can deform, like we could say, deform the origin to another set of formula.
Deform the contour away from the origin? So we could, if we want to use the saddle point approximation, we have to pass through a critical point.
Yeah, but I mean, we could deform it to like another critical point.
We would have to be careful in that case.
Yeah, so that there's probably ways you could deform it without changing the value and do other saddle point approximation. This is certainly the simplest. There's no question that only counting this critical point, we can use the saddle point approximation and deform our contour so it passes through at this angle.
Was there another question?
Answer it. Okay. So all that's left to do is compute the derivatives of G. And so G of W naught is 1. G double prime of W naught is minus nu squared. And without any other work, we have the asymptotic formula as z goes to infinity for the Hankel function, which is e to the minus I pi nu over 2 over pi root 2 pi over z e to the I z e to the minus I pi over 4 times 1 plus nu squared I over 2z plus dot dot dot. Okay. And we'll look at more physical applications in the tutorial today. So the reason we're discussing this again is, I said, many of the same ideas are applicable when we're doing perturbation theory in QFT. The full saddle point method, you don't often need to use all of those ideas at once, but they do explain this is basically the most general thing we can do in one dimension and what we're going to do when we do perturbation theory. Starting from the path integral formalism in QFT is basically just approximating things using infinite dimensional Gaussian functions. So many of these ideas will come back, even if we won't necessarily use all of them, although perhaps we will. And so that's basically all I wanted to say today. So we've seen for the course of the last four lectures, learned about distributions, gamma and zeta functions, orthogonal functions, and today learned something about asymptotics. So I haven't been able to say everything that will be useful to you over the course of the year. So I hope you just take this as a starting point to learn more about these subjects. Thank you.